board. January 26, 1926.
Yes, sir. Where was this?
Well, I was born in Oda.
Oda?
Yeah.
Did you pretty much raise right around there?
Yeah. My dad on the farm out there west of Oda. Between Edry and West Hampton.
Yes, sir. And
we had just done in Oda to be near Walker from Mohead, and I was born over at 1.5 in Monte Saddle. And as soon as it snowed that year, by the way, it was snowing on the ground when I was born. And then, you know, as soon as we got, my mother got okay, we went back to that farm. I stayed out there on that farm until I was graduated high school, 17.
When you went and signed up in the service?
Yeah, well, I was out about out of school about almost a year, but it wasn't quite. Rather than go through the draft business, I went down out for my 18th birthday and joined the Navy. And of course, I was.
Was you wanting to go in?
I was, yeah.
What was you hoping? What happened to you?
Learned
how to do something?
Well, you know, the thing was a patriotic thing, getting that service, and I guess with almost all wars, it is.
Yes, sir.
And I guess like some of the uprisings that we've had, where we had, like Korea and Vietnam and that kind of thing, there wasn't as much of that patriotism as it was back then, in World War II.
What'd you think of the war? Do you think is we got a pretty good chance of winning?
Yeah. I don't think that ever entered my mind, because through the time that I got in there, well, things had already been switched around. They were already winning.
They were already on the road.
Yeah. It was one of those things where we had to win that thing. I was old enough to realize what was going on. When it started.
Yes, sir.
And I guess, you know, you would have those setbacks and those kind of things in there, but it was never any doubt. I don't think in anybody's mind we're going to lose that thing. And it was just more of a fight that we had to do with it.
Yes, sir. My granddad fought the Germans. He went in there at 1940. He said that nobody knew whether or not they could win, just knew they had to do it.
Yeah, well, like I said, well, a good time I was got in there, well, that thing was already headed our way, and I knew we had won, too, but it's the time I had to get in there.
So you went over in the Pacific with the Navy?
Yeah. I went through tech school, aviation machinist mate. And then we had about, that was about 6 months long. And before I got through with that, well, I was in aviation gunnery.
Did you go to school in California?
I went to Norman, Oklahoma. That's where I got that, got the aviation machinist rating. And then I went, started on aero gunnery. Certain amount of those people that went into those, I guess you call them crafts, different crafts like mechanics and ordnance. Well, they make gunners out of them. And they gave us a choice. I think it was three different choices. One of them was somewhere in the Pensacola, Florida, in Corpus Christi, and Jacksonville, Florida. To take a draft training, aviation gunnery training, and I started to pick Pensacola because I always figured the Navy sent you someplace good and long ago.
Yeah.
But anyway, they told me, said, now you have a good chance of going carpet, you did carpet down. So I did, and I trained in carpet in Kingsville, with Gunnery. And then went out to the West Coast. I guess landed out there at Los Alamitos was a station, was the base I went to out there. And then I signed up for a transfer, and we were in casualty units, and casualty units were just, they were going to go overseas someday. And I thought that I might get on out, you know. But I didn't. They sent me down to Hopewell, California. That's 39 miles west of Yuma, Arizona, down there in that desert.
That ain't much of a place for a Navy man.
Well, I'm telling you, that was rough duty down there. 115, 120 at midnight down there. And when I got down there to Hopewell, they hadn't completed those barracks. They had the runways. It was an operational base, but it didn't have any quarters.
What were they training y'all to do there?
Well, they was mostly what that was about. That was year-round flying down there, and they was making those squadrons. But I never did get in a squadron down there. And then they shipped me to the Pacific.
So how long had you been in the service by that time?
By then? I'd been in there about 14 months, I guess.
Yes, sir.
And we went out, and we got 3 days on the other side of Pearl Harbor, they dropped the first atomic bomb.
What were you thinking when they did that?
I thinking that was good, because we were, you know, we were headed, I figured we were headed for back up in the invasion of Japan, so somewhere in there we'd have got into something. If we'd have went on in Japan, we would have. And that's the way it was headed, of course. But
did you know anything about them atomic bombs before?
I hadn't heard a thing in the world about it until they dropped it. When they dropped that thing, and went, you know, talking, they announced it over on board ship. They announced it in, and then when they dropped the second, the next time they dropped it bomb, well, they was talking peace.
Yes, sir.
And so I didn't actually see any combat. I was in combat zone, but it was, because we was anything in that Pacific, I guess at that time, was considered a combat zone. And in the Asiatic Pacific, I think it started somewhere around Pearl Harbor or just out of Pearl Harbor. But I went on to the Philippines. I guess that was going to be a staging area for that invasion, the Philippines. And then we came back to Guam, and then came back. I wound up over on Kwajalein in the Marshall Islands.
Yes, sir. Was it kind of an occupation?
No, it wasn't. They had all those natives that moved them off of that island because it made the base there. And the only natives left on there was just, we had a workforce of Marshallese men. And moved all the women off. And the men rotated back, you know, they left so many of them work so long, and they sent them back to wherever their families were for a certain length of time, then they brought them back, you know, swapped them out back and forth back here. But I left Kwajalein, and just about the time I got there, they started building the bunker for the atomic bomb. And they had all kind of scary rumors out about that thing. But there we were on an island, and I think that thing was about 5 miles long and a mile and a half wide. That island was, and they didn't build that thing right on the end of it. They built it back up in the, about I guess it was about a foot away from the west end of where they built that bunker. And they would, they already had that thing. Where I left, they had an airplane. They had a B-29 setting up on that thing. That's where they was keeping that bomb, or planning to keep the bombs when they brought them to the island. I think there wasn't any bomb there when I was there. If it was, I never did know it. But I left out there about April of 46. And I had enough points to get out of service. I was in the Naval Reserve.
Did you decide to get out of it?
Yeah, I left it. I couldn't think of anything but to get back here, you know, in this part of the country around my family. I never been away from them, of course. I got over being homesick pretty quick, but I still a whole lot rather be here. But anyway, when we got back, well, you could get a job almost any place in the United States then. That thing was still booming because they'd gotten behind on manufacturers' automobiles, they'd gotten behind on farm equipment. All sorts of things they'd been putting off for the war effort. So jobs were still plentiful. I mean, I guess they were as plentiful then as they was during the war. And during the war, they were plentiful. When I was in California in the service, I worked at Douglas Aircraft Factory. We could go there and work 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours, or 8 hours. And we'd go in the gate, you'd tell them how many hours you're going to work, or wanted to work. And when you came out, at whatever time that you said you wanted to leave, well, they'd have to pay money for you. So,
they was working on Navy hands as contractors, huh?
Yeah. We just did those labor type things in there, you know. That didn't have to have any learning at all. But we wanted to go out that night. We got up at 4 o'clock, and we had worked 4 hours. And I know they paid us about $1, $1.25 an hour.
It wouldn't be bad for him, was it?
You could go to town on that. Well, I never did have any trouble getting a job.
Do you know what
I went in, huh?
Do you have any idea what you wanted to do when you got there?
Not really.
Didn't have no.
I was working in my office when I left here for the service. I've been working in my office, and I went back in. When I got back, I worked in a parts department for Lincoln Mercury dealership for the last 6 months and like the boss did. So I went back to Orpheus in 47, I guess, till 53. I worked in Orpheus.
Oh, man.
Yeah, well, we were getting out on platforms in the bays in shallow water. It was in, we worked in New Age Bay and in Corpus Christi Bay and up in Coconut Bay. Worked on, started off on barges and then went on back on the piling.
You know, we just starting off doing it.
Yeah. Then when I left, well, we were on the barge, but it was all that shallow water stuff. And we just worked a record shift, you know, because we could get there and back. Just rigging back in a few minutes. Anyway, I decided the oil field wasn't for me. And after we got that Sundance, where it was then, Sun Company, about 51%, they just called it Sundance.
It was kind of new back then, wasn't it?
That refinery was put in it. Well, when I got there, they had They like one unit having all of them on stream. And I worked about a week and shut the whole bunch down. And went back, the cat messed up. And I just stayed down about 45 days and then we fired back up.
45 took days? Off.
Yeah, I thought I was out of job. I thought it was all over. Of course, they were saying, well, no, it's not going to be. We're going to get this thing fixed. But boy, it was tore up down there around. Inside reactors and regenerators, all the refractory falling out of those two vessels. That's what it amounted to. But
they didn't have as much experience in that kind of stuff as they
do now. I didn't have any experience in there, but you know, all field people knew how to work.
Yes, sir.
And I still to today, and I did it. I worked there 38 years, and if I had an opportunity to hire an oil field person, a person who'd been in oil field for a while, I would take that guy 90% of the time, because they're coming in at green anyway. Whoever you're getting was going to be green. And the oil field people just had a way of getting around. They could work in those places. They knew how to work, and they arranged it, and protein and that kind of thing, and that was just part of it. I hired several of those oil field people. And it proved to be awful good hands. So I stayed out there 38 years, so I didn't have much to worry about a job. I was fortunate. You know, by 53, the oil field slowed down some, and I was driving 80 miles to the rig and having to live away from home part of the time. But you go to driving, say, 160 miles in 16 hours, less than 16 hours. You know, about 80 miles up there and 80 miles back. Well, I got out of that. That's what really got me out of that oil field.
Yes, sir.
Started looking where I could stay in one place.
So did any of the stuff you learned in the military help you?
In private life?
Yes, sir.
I don't think it's anything. But we didn't have the opportunities in that service to develop a sense of decision making. You know, we didn't.
What about mechanical ability and all that kind of stuff?
Well, that aviation machinist mate was really all in mind to was, you know, making an aviation mechanic out of you.
Yes, sir.
And when I got into the casualty groups, all we were responsible for in there. What I didn't go into working on airplanes. What we did, we would fuel the plane. We had a fuel truck roll by, and we'd fuel it, and we'd check the oil, and oil, we'd get oil off that fuel trucks. And then we would crank it up after we got it fueled up. We'd crank it up and run it out and check all the transportation that we could check and check the
grill crew.
Yeah. And when the pilot got there, we would buckle him up, get him in there, get him safely, and we'd sit down and wait for him to get back. If he made it back, we would undo him, and then we'd do the same thing over. As soon as the plane was parked, we'd go into the routine of filming, you know, service. And checking them to see if they're all right, and then wait for the next hop. So you don't get too much education out of something like that. Well, there ain't no pilots left. You've got to have several more people in there supporting those pilots and planes than you do
pilots.
So you pretty much learned everything you need to know from the oil field, huh?
To make a living, that's
yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, not really. I just learned how to work, and
it was
a pretty good, run pretty much like the maintenance around the oil rig was pretty much like a refinery to me.
Yes,
sir. So if you could do one, you'd do the other. But like I said, I was really fortunate through all my working days of having a good job. Also, it was a good job. It made pretty good money, but you had to work 7 days a week to do it. Land the refineries, well, it was a drop in pay, but it didn't take long to get up, and surpass what you're making oil field. I made a whole lot more money working in oil and up in refineries after I got up. Up there, had an idea that it would have made out in oil field. So, I guess things ran through my working life. There wasn't too much of that worry about the job.
Yes, sir. So, you pretty much just been right around here except for that being in the service.
Yeah, I was down for, I guess, probably a year I spent overseas. Probably a year away from South Texas in the United States.
Yes, sir. Another net, pretty much.
So I was pretty much in touch,
Been down here your whole life.
Yeah. Yeah, when I came out of service, I came back to Corpus. I was already living in Corpus when I went to service, so I came back to Corpus. I lived there. I came out here. I just came out here in the last month or so of
90. All right, well, thank you, Pete.
Well, hope I helped you.
Yes, sir. That's pretty much all I need.
That's okay, Pete. He had made enough money down there forming sharecropping that in 1923 he went out there and bought that farm. And he paid cash for that, which was not very much. He wasn't about $4 an acre, but that was $1,600.
Where was this at?
That was out between Edroy and West Sutton.
Yes, sir.
It's 4 miles in there, and we were about half, just right at halfway, like a quarter of a mile being in there halfway. But that's when he bought that right here, see.
You growing cotton?
Mostly. We had to grow some feed because we were working horses, farming with horses, and we had cattle. We lived off of their calves and off the milk. But then when that depression hit, you see, there wasn't anybody had any damn money coming through these years here. The farmers, I read here a while back where the farmers really did get whipping. Took a beating in that depression, but that wasn't his. We didn't have no damn money nohow. We were growing up.
Didn't they have the dust bowl along with them too?
Yeah, but they're back out there. Yeah, those people
wasn't
hurt.
They wasn't out here.
They migrated to West Coast out of Oklahoma.
The depression plus the dust bowl probably
West Texas.
A lot worse than it did y'all.
But you see, we grew everything. The only thing we bought to eat was salt and pepper. We grew corn, and there was a mill there at Edroy, one of those gins, and they ground that corn. They'd take your corn, they'd grind your corn and take out so much meal for the grinding.
Yes, sir.
So they gave you had your meal free, you might say.
And you had some left over?
Well, they would take so much of it for grinding, which is very little, but they'd take that. And anyway, and then you had too much cornmeal, so you'd sell that. I mean, you'd trade that for flour, because we didn't raise wheat, but he had wheat, and he ground wheat. He ground flour there. So we'd swap our cornmeal for how much flour we needed. And So you see, we didn't, we raised beef, we ate the calves, the fish, we hunted, and my dad did. And that's the way we got along. Hell, we didn't have no money all them years today. And here, this thing ran up to 40. But so it was pretty deep here along 31. It was a pretty big depression back then. But during 1933, my dad took a bale of cotton to Corpus. He had his gin there in Israel and took a bale of cotton to Corpus. And he come back with a radio. That was our first radio, in 1933. And we didn't have electricity out there, never did. We never did have electricity out there as long as I lived out there. But he had a dry battery running that radio. What are you chewing on, all that coke bottle? You know, things we didn't have no money anyway. We didn't have a nickel nowhere along the line. Every once in a while along there, I guess it was after the war had started, I remember, well, we got to go to a movie about once every 2 weeks. Go to a theater over at Mathis. But hell, it probably didn't cost us a nickel to get in there then. Wages had started picking up, things started picking up. Dad was working out, and I was big enough to get out there. Me and my mother formed. We did the foreman, he went to work out. He didn't do hardly any foreman after I got big enough to do it. My brother was going to the service. He went in late 40s for 2 or 3 months, and he stayed 6 years or whatever it was. He spent 3 years over on Ocean Island. And Steve told me that Biggin was over there, Ocean Island.
He was for a little while.
He was there probably in the invasion car.
Yes, sir.
When they went in, they finally got that. It didn't take them too long to get that.
Right after it was over, they sent him in on the Big Island for occupation, to occupy the place. He was some of the first ones in there.
Well, a launch was too. They went in there and them Japs, some of them was committing suicide because they thought they were in a hell of an invasion, you know.
Yeah, I heard that their leaders told them they'd be better off killing themselves because if we caught them, we'd eat them. We'd torture them to death and then we'd eat them. That's why a lot of them would rather die than get caught.
Well, I saw somewhere some of them Marines come out of the Pacific when I was up there in school at Norman. Well, they had a big military hospital over there in Norman.
Yes, sir.
And they asked us to go over and visit those guys that's in the hospital. And some of them have come back to water now, no time places. Boy, I'll tell you, they have some pictures that you never did see, unless you were talking to some of them guys that were in there. They were chopping them Japs head off. Them Marines were, they the hell I used to have pictures, and they had them holding them heads up, some of them with two hands, pictures of them knocking them gold teeth out of their heads, getting that gold. And I saw some of that gold, bird arm sacks, that bore that damn road. But they said, well, hell, they're doing it to us, you know. So then it finally gets, you know, you finally get to where you live just like them. It was pretty mean to them. Them Japs, those guys were.
Standard operating procedure for Japs was cut off your head.
Oh yeah, well,
they
cut them off and them alive. These Marines was running up on them dead and just holding, you know, cut their head off and holding them up just for the.
Probably cut them off with their own sword too.
Yeah, but them Japs, yeah, I was at Quadron. I mean, they held those some of those war calls. They held them there. And, we used to go down there if we had time to go down there to court. sit in there. And then Jeff, one of them Jeff said yes. I got upset with myself. Said it would take me sometimes two licks to cut a head off with my to behead a man with my what was it,
samurai sword.
And he said I was upset with my ability. Said you're supposed to be able to do that one swing of that sword. But you know those guys, I didn't go too much. He told me, well, they still didn't feel bad about what they did unless they made a mistake of what was thought of what they were supposed to do. And then they felt bad about it. But as far as what they did to the people, they didn't feel bad even in them trials out there. It didn't show up as such. They were still big macho Jap leaders, you know. Even after they were in prison, they imprisoned them. So you couldn't feel too much different than a heck of a lot of animosity toward those Japanese people. That's still with me today, some of it is. And I just, it's hard, you know, hard to get out of your system because you knew what they did. It was truth. Well, I'd tell my bosses, you people are getting there, you want to work this thing just like that, because the dimming way thing out there at the plant. See, and they went right on and did it. Of course, I knew that I wasn't going to restrict it any, but I would try to talk to the individual and say, listen, man, you ought to be thinking about this. I don't know what you can do about it, but at least not be just like you swallowing hook, line, and sinker, and people did it. And now it's got into be a hell of a mess, and that's been anyway what caused a lot of that stuff. I told them, I said, you said, well, that's 45, 50 years ago when them Japs were doing all that. Yeah, but do you think they wouldn't try that again if they thought they had a chance? If they had the same opportunities they did back there when they hit Pearl Harbor, they'd do it in a minute. They would do it in a minute. But they were convinced they were going to win that war. They'd never fired the first shot, you know, and they would have sneaked in and done what they done. Anyway, people are losing touch of, you know, with that kind of thing. I haven't, but I think it. People that younger people are getting away from that, and especially where they don't hear about it. You know. Some people never heard anything about that.
It's even worse for the Japanese. Almost none of them know what happened.
They completely left that out of all their teachings and things. You know, they can't believe it. Some of the things that happened, even after they hear about it, they can't believe it. What they're hearing.
It's not like the Germans were to drill it into them over and over what happened. The Germans.
Yeah, that was a heck of a time back then, you know. One side of you is out there on the Germans and Italians have been hornswoggled into that almost to a citizen. Almost every one of those people were fanatics. And how that happened, just that doggles my mind. I'm sure there's people that figured it out or figured it out of how those things happen. But I can't understand it. I hadn't put much thought in it, just a little bit. And then Japanese people were the same. They just lived and breathed that here to eat, though. But all of that stuff taking place like it did, you know, at the same time there. It was just kind of hard for me to even visualize it ever happening. Because I wasn't old enough to even think about it sensibly when it started. It wasn't much, didn't have much more sense about stuff like that when it was over. It makes you wonder whatever in the world ever happened to so many different people to go berserk or motor, go off into being fanatics about things like they did.
They're still trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I never will. I don't guess I ever did. Really worth a crime.
Well,
yeah. Old Hitler, he didn't take it. If you really look at what he did in the short time that he did it, how did he do it? You know, how did he get so much power over the people?
If 90% of it, he was in the right place at the right time and told everybody what they wanted to hear.
Yeah, about how he's going to bring them out of nothing to being something, I guess.
Yes, sir.
But I doubt very seriously if those German people got any wage benefit out of that while it was going on. They was, you know, working in under dictatorship over there. They may not have benefited a nickel's worth out of that.
Well, I believe that he did.
Did he pay them good and all that?
Yep.
Yeah.
They did pretty good while they were going on. The German people. Anybody else didn't do too well. Pretty much brought them out on a rail.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
They got some pretty good free labor over there too, didn't they?
Yeah, they had slave labor. And them companies are still going over there. They had them too. Siemens. There's several other big companies that had.
I guess you couldn't do much about that.
Mercedes. I
don't know. But done it, I don't know how those people would have survived, you know. German people, how would they have survived if you'd taken all of their factories away?